Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I think it's delightful that we have Jeffrey Toobin with us on the first Monday in October, the day the Supreme Court starts its new session. And they evidently will be looking at some very consequential issues, not that they always don't, but some very consequential issues as they did last session with health care, this session with affirmative action, with perhaps same-sex marriage, with voting rights issues. Jeffrey Toobin has been following the court carefully and in a very interesting fashion for a number of years. He's staff writer at The New Yorker, senior legal analyst at CNN, and author of his latest book is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. He's also author of the bestseller The Nine, Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, and The Run of His Life. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jeffrey during the course of this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Jeffrey, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you. It's a fascinating book. They always are. I'm just wondering, as the Supreme Court justices begin their session today, you write in the book about how this can be kind of a lonely job. You can't talk about what you're doing. You're cut off from everybody. Is there anything that they do on a day like today, like have breakfast together or have some kind of celebration? Here they are again, deciding momentous issues, or are they on their own, walking quietly to the Supreme Court?
You know, as in so many areas, substantively and otherwise, Sandra Day O'Connor was really an innovator in this regard. She recognized the loneliness of the job, and she created a bunch of social institutions at the court that continue, even though she's gone from the court. They have lunch together every day that they sit. They invite guests. Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia often arrange for opera singers to come join them. There are a lot of social occasions involving visiting judges from around the world. Those sorts of things bring the justices together. But when it comes to the substance of their work, it is, as you suggest, a very lonely job. Mm-hmm. Every Friday morning, on the weeks where they hear arguments, the nine of them go into the conference, the Chief Justice's conference room, and and no one else is there. No one else is involved in the discussion, and that's the core of what it means to be a Supreme Court justice. What goes on in that room?
Hmm. I was interested that she had people. She actually required people, I think, her female clerks to do workout sessions with her three days
right.
a week.
You know, not many people know there is a basketball court on the top floor of the Supreme Court, which is nicknamed the highest court in the land. And Byron White played basketball there with his clerks for many years. But in the spirit of integrating the court, Justice O'Connor created aerobics classes that were more or less required for her female law clerks and most other female law clerks at the court. And that institution also survives as well.
Yeah. Let's talk about differences in philosophies now between Republicans and Democrats as to how they view the Supreme Court. You write early in the book that the modern Republican Party has put judicial issues near the top of their agenda. Democrats have not done that. Why is that?
Well, this really goes back to, I think, a very underrated figure in recent American history, and that's Edwin Meeks, who was an aide to President Reagan and later the Attorney General. He was someone who came to Washington with the real idea of bringing legal issues to the fore for the Republican Party. What were they? Expand executive power, speed up executions, end racial preferences intended to assist African Americans, lower the barriers between church and state, and above all, reverse Roe versus Wade and allow states once again to ban abortion. This agenda has continued through the 80s, the 90s, and into this century. And the critical development is really the disappearance of moderate Republicans who dominated the court and in many respects dominated the Congress as well. They are gone from the court just like they're gone from Congress, and that agenda remains at the heart of what it means to be a Republican.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, before we talk about more of the substance of the book, today is the opening session, the cases that are controversial, highly partisan issues that they will be taking up. And why don't we start, because there is an election, with voting rights. What are they going to be looking at concerning voting rights?
Well, they are probably going to be reviewing the status of the Voting Rights Act, which is, of course, the landmark of 1965, which created the institutions for states, mostly in the South, where they could not change anything about their voting rules without getting what's called pre-clearance or permission from the Justice Department. The Southern states have really chafed at this requirement. They say times have changed. It's not 1965 anymore. And there's a case challenging whether the Voting Rights Act should still be on the books.
Are they going to be looking at all at voter ID laws, Jeffrey?
No, they are not. And in one of the more surprising and decisions of John Paul Stevens, the great liberal, in a case out of Indiana a few years ago, he approved for a majority, mostly including the conservative justices, voter ID rules, that picture ID requirements are clearly constitutional. Now, there are various issues around the margins that other courts have looked at, but the idea that the court can require, that states can require picture IDs, that is clearly constitutional based on Supreme Court precedent.
Same-sex marriage, will they be taking that up this session?
Well, this is really the $64 question of this term, because there are two cases, both related but actually quite different, about the issue of same-sex marriage. The first is the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, which says that the federal government cannot recognize same-sex marriages, even in states where it is legal. A federal appeals court in Boston has struck that down. So that's one case. The other case is the Proposition 8 case out of California, which is much more of a general challenge to whether ban same-sex marriage at all. The real difference between the two is the Defense of Marriage Act only applies in states that already have same-sex marriage. The Proposition 8 case is much more a challenge to all states, whether any state has the right to ban same-sex marriage. It's a much broader case.
A lot of the book looks at in such an interesting fashion, the philosophy, the character makeup, and the brilliance, actually, of both John Roberts and Barack Obama. Let's start with Roberts. And I want to get to the Affordable Care Act fairly quickly here. You talk about his professional career being as much about ideology as brilliance and charm. His work has mirrored and hastened the conservative movement in the law. Does he act as an ideological man, a political man? Because I know you write that some of the other justices do when he is deliberating. And by what?
They all do.
They all do.
One of the myths about the Supreme Court is that you can be a Supreme Court justice who just follows the law independent of ideology. There is no way of doing that job that way. When you are talking about questions like, does the Constitution protect the right to an abortion? May a university use race in admissions? Does the Commerce Clause allow the Affordable Care Act to be passed? All those questions are highly relevant that are impossible to separate from ideology. And that's what, and that's true for the Chief Justice, and it's true for the eight others as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend some time on the Affordable Care Act, because the ramifications of his vote and how he came to his vote. Basically, was he looking for a way to compromise because he realized how momentous a decision this was, Jeffrey. So he was looking for any possibility to uphold at least the substance of the bill?
I think that was certainly part of what he was talking about, about what he was trying to do. I think it's appropriate to see the Affordable Care Act case as really part three in a Supreme Court trilogy. The first is Bush v. Gore in 2000. The second is Citizens United in 2010. The third is the Obamacare case. In the first two, you had five Republicans ruling in a Republican way on intensely polarized political issues. After the oral argument, it looked to me, certainly, as well as to others, that the court was going to do that as well in the Affordable Care Act case. And Roberts is the custodian of the court's public reputation. He does not want to see the court as just another place where Democrats and Republicans fight, just a smaller House of Representatives. So he was looking for a way to break the partisan logjam, and he found this rather curious, unusual way of justifying the law under the taxing power that allowed him to uphold the decision. It was certainly a surprise to me. I'm still surprised today, but I think you can see it as making sense from Roberts' perspective.
And how did the other conservative justices make their displeasure known to Roberts?
Well, you know, I think there's a little misinformation about this subject as well. Look, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, they were very, very disappointed by Chief Justice Roberts' ruling in this case. But part of what it means to be a Supreme Court justice is to know that you're going to lose some cases and that you are not but everyone is a repeat player there. There is no percentage in holding grudges there. So, yes, they were angry, but, yes, they got over it quickly, and the new term will begin today with a clean slate. So the idea that there is some sort of permanent breach in the court, I think, is just silly.
And I love the comments that he decided, Thomas, that is, to go to Malta after this, which you describe as an impregnable fortress, or he described it that way.
Roberts did, yes.
Yeah, what did I say? Roberts, I meant.
Yeah.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Jeffrey. Jeffrey Toobin is our guest this hour. His book is The Oath, The Obama White House, and the Supreme Court. And we're speaking on the day that the Supreme Court begins its next term, first Monday in October. Two phone calls for you in a moment. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. You can go to our Facebook page as well, the Kathleen Dunn Show, or tweet to @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, Nancy Pearl, our favorite librarian, will be joining us, and Daniel Golden will be here as well, and we'll be talking about book recommendations, always one of our favorite hours, so that's coming up tomorrow during the 10 o'clock hour. Our first call for Jeffrey is Jeff in Door County. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Toobin. 1954, just before the court took the vote on Brown versus Board of Education, it was said that Chief Justice Earl Warren, in contemplating what to do, took his assistant, who he had known for a number of years, went to the Maryland countryside, stopped in at a hotel, but he couldn't get in because his friend was black. And supposedly that was a defining moment for Earl Warren. The question is, yesterday in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, an article appeared about the court's new session, sort of like a preemptory to your discussion this morning. And it rose a question, or a broader question about, and that is the Chief Justice going to try to, is he going to be moving more to the center to try to sort of replace Kennedy so that it becomes more of his court? Or what we saw in the last case, the Affordable Care Act, was that more of an anachronism, just a a special thing.
Okay, good question. Jeffrey?
My answer is I don't expect a dramatic change in Chief Justice Roberts. I think the Affordable Care Act was very much an anomaly. I think he has not suddenly discovered his inner moderate. He is a conservative. He is a conservative particularly on racial issues. I think when the court takes up the affirmative action case, he is very likely to be voting down affirmative action, and I just think the court what we saw in the Affordable Care Act is not going to be repeated in any long series of cases. The Chief Justice Roberts is a conservative and will remain that way.
When the Commerce Clause was not the reason for upholding affordable care, it was the taxing power. What does that mean in terms of future deliberations, this Commerce Clause business?
To tell you the truth, I don't think it means much. Mm. I think yes, they did say that the Commerce Clause was outside the power, that the individual mandate requirement to buy health insurance was impermissible under the Commerce Clause. But I don't think this signals a dramatic cutback in federal power under the Commerce Clause. I guess I am sufficiently cynical about how they approach their precedents that that this case was so anomalous, they are not going to use this precedent dramatically to change the law about what the federal government can do.
And Jeffrey, do you want to confirm that Earl Warren moment as being pivotal in his decision for Brown?
Well, I actually don't. I have heard similar stories. I mean, it is true that Earl Warren, had a real awakening about racial issues. I'm not sure it was that incident in particular. I think one issue that was very significant to Earl Warren is that, remember, 1954 was the height of the Cold War, and the United States was waging an ideological war against the Soviet Union around the world, and at the same time, we were claiming the moral high ground. We were segregating large portions of the country, and I think Warren, as well as many others, found it simply intolerable that it was against the national security interests of the United States to continue discriminating against black people in that way. So I think that was also a big factor in what made Brown possible. Mm.
Our next caller, what are the chances of having Jeffrey as a guest in our first two callers named Jeff? It's Jeffrey's day. Jeff in Superior, hi.
Hi, good morning. Great conversation. Thank you. I believe that in the past couple generations, in the past 100 years in the United States, American Catholics have surged into leadership positions. And from what I understand, there's 5 or 6 members of the Supreme Court who are Catholic. Do you think that their religious affiliation is affecting their decisions? And if it is, why aren't they taking up the abortion issue?
I think you're certainly right that there are 6 Catholics on the court. There are actually 6 Catholics and 3 Jews. There are no Protestants on the court for the first time in history, which is certainly a novelty in the court's history. I actually think it is not terribly significant that there are 6 Catholics on the court. The Catholics on the court have included William Brennan, who was perhaps the greatest liberal in the court's history. Sonia Sotomayor is Catholic. John Roberts, Samuel Alito, Sonia Sotomayor, they were all picked for the court because of their ideology, not because of their religion. Catholics hold a wide variety of views on issues, including abortion. In fact, my understanding is that Catholics' views on abortion are essentially indistinguishable from everybody else's views about abortion. So I actually find the religious makeup of the court interesting as a historical curiosity, but not, in fact, all that significant in terms of how the court decides cases.
If you would please, you start your book with that oath of office and give us some interesting details that Roberts thought that he could rely on his memory here. It's a very interesting story. Could you tell us that story, why it was redone? And
well, you know, this is one of the reasons I love being a journalist, is because you get to sort of revisit things that pass very quickly, and everybody thinks they know what happened, but in fact, they don't. What happened was this, is that John Roberts and his top aide prepared meticulously for the oath administration. Starting even before Obama was elected, they got out a card that William Rehnquist had used to map out how the oath should be administered, and it divided the words according to each sort of how it would be administered, and they sent that card in an email as an attachment to a secretary on the staff of the congressional committee that was supervising the inauguration. Well, in the ways of emails, this secretary either never opened the email, never either lost the attachment, never read it. It was never forwarded to Obama's staff. So Obama did not know how Roberts was dividing the oath. And, you know, Roberts prepared relentlessly. His wife had said to him at one point, said, at this point, the dog thinks it's the president because he had rehearsed so much at home. But what happened was on the morning of at noon when the oath was administered, Obama interrupted Roberts in the first stanza because he didn't know when Roberts was stopping. That, very uncharacteristically, flustered Roberts, and Roberts was and that's what led to the problems. But it was really a misplaced email that led to that was the start of all the problems.
And then tell the other part of the story, because they're having to redo it, and it became important for this White House to redo it because there were some who were already questioning whether or not he was born in the country.
Well, that's right. And here's where the politics becomes significant. You know, Robert, one of the movements that has been ascended at the Supreme Court in recent years is known as textualism, which basically says the Constitution should be interpreted precisely according to the text, and not there is no like anything that's not in the text is not in the Constitution. Most famously, this applies to the right of privacy. Liberals say there's a right to privacy in the Constitution. Textualists say no, it's not mentioned in the Constitution, so it's not, it doesn't exist. Well, some of the lawyers in the Obama administration who were looking at the oath problem on January 20th and 21st said, you know, what if the textualists say that it has to be administered precisely according to the text? Now, I don't think any of them actually believe that Obama was not the president, but they did think that someone might file a lawsuit, there might be a distraction, there might be a hearing. You know, you can imagine how distracting that would have been. So they decided that it was the better part of valor to ask the Chief Justice to redo the oath, and that's why 7 o'clock, about 30 hours after the first administration of the oath, they did it again, this time at the White House.
And Roberts was relying on his memory, which was usually top notch for both occasions. Perhaps he should have had a card himself.
That's right. It will be interesting to see that on January 20th, 2013,
yes,
regardless of who he's swearing in,
right,
how John Roberts chooses to do it. My bet is he's a very proud man. He will continue to rely on his memory, and I bet it'll go pretty smoothly.
Jeffrey Toobin is our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. His latest book is The Oath, The Obama White House, and the Supreme Court, which has fascinating information, not only on that oath where he starts the book, but he ends the book with great information about the Affordable Care Act, and interspersed lots of historical information about the court and analysis of the personalities of all of the people who have been on the court and those who have left as well. Will in Dodgeville is our next caller. Jeffrey, hi, Will.
Hi, thank you. Two quick questions for Mr. Toobin. The first would be, I understand there's a couple of Fourth Amendment kind of research and seizure cases that are coming? Could you very briefly outline them and the main arguments, pro and con? And then secondly, if time or into willing to do this, the Republican-led voter registration laws sweeping the nation, isn't it a bit ironic at best, dishonest at worst for Republicans who, with their anti-government stuff, to insist on government-issued IDs? So, but the Fourth Amendment first, it's a more important issue, I think.
Thank you, Lynn.
Okay, well, I can take care of the Fourth Amendment question very quickly. I don't know what the Fourth Amendment cases are this year. There are always Fourth Amendment cases. You know, the issues of whether you can search a car and under what circumstances you can search someone's home. I mean, these are issues that the court returns to over and over again. Frankly, I don't know what the pending cases are in the Fourth Amendment area this term. You know, as for voter ID, I think it's quite apparent that the Republican legislatures that won in the 2010 midterm elections, and this applies in Wisconsin and all through the Midwest as well as Florida, established these new voter ID rules. Now they claim that it was designed to combat voter fraud, which appears, based on everything I've seen, to be a non-existent problem in the United States. The court has, as I mentioned earlier, said that that picture ID requirements are constitutional in a general way. How those laws are applied in the real world becomes more controversial. And there have been court cases. I don't see any way the Supreme Court will be involved before November on that particular issue. Other courts have been. There's a case pending in Pennsylvania today about these issues. But I am not I don't think the Supreme Court will get involved before the election.
And let's spend a few more minutes on election-related court decisions. At its heart, you write in the book, Citizens United, which is, of course, is playing out in a big way in the presidential election and other important elections, you say it was basically a case about Republicans versus Democrats. What do you mean by that, Jeffrey?
Well, this was a case about deregulating campaigns. In a general way, the cause of campaign finance reform, of limiting contributions, of limiting who can contribute, of limiting how much they contribute, under what circumstances, when. This has been a Democratic cause, with relatively few exceptions. Unlimited campaign contributions help Republicans more, period. This is something that everyone knows. If you are letting people give millions of dollars to campaigns, especially corporations, which is what Citizens United was specifically about, you are helping Republicans. And, you know, people find it convenient to talk about this case in terms of abstractions, about freedom of speech, about whether corporations are people or not. But in brutal political fact, Citizens United was a case that was an enormous gift to the Republican Party. And the justices are highly aware of that fact. Now, I am not so cynical to suggest that that was the only reason the five Republican justices voted for the result that they did in the Citizens United case, but it is a fact that that all nine of them were aware of.
Jerry Ann in South Milwaukee, our next caller. Hi, Jerry Ann.
Hi, and hi, Jeff. I don't know if you remember me from years back in L.A., the Simpson trial.
I didn't hear your name.
I was Jerry Ann Hazlett.
Jerry Ann Hazlett. Oh, my goodness. Yes.
I can barely hear. I don't know what's wrong with the connection. I can barely.
Well, you should explain what you did, Jerry Ann.
What did you do there, Jerry Ann?
Oh, I worked for the courts. I was the media liaison for the Los Angeles courts during a time that included a number of high-profile trials. The Simpson criminal trial in 95 and the civil trial in 95.
Jerry Ann had to be the intermediary between Judge Lance Ito, and the news media, and all those issues about the cameras in the courtroom.
Oh, my.
Jerry Ann was the person in the middle, and she did a great job. and it was difficult, tense work.
I imagine.
Found the current court to be any more political or partisan or fractious than courts past, and if related to that, it seems as to me as if a number of state courts are kind of following along the current partisanship of the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that unusual, or is that we just don't have a good institutional memory of times past?
Well, I think the Supreme Court has always been a deeply political institution, whether it was the period leading up to slavery and the horrible decisions like Dred Scott, or in the period around the turn of the century where you had very pro-corporate decisions, and later in the New Deal, after the New Deal, the Supreme Court has been very political. But one thing, one tremendous advantage that the United States Supreme Court has over many state courts is that the justices are appointed, not elected. In Wisconsin, this is, of course, a very big issue, that partisan elections or any kind of elections for state Supreme Courts have become absolute dogfights with money playing a huge role. I mean, you've seen this in Wisconsin repeatedly. It's been true in Ohio, Pennsylvania. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, in her retirement, has made the cause of her life preserving an appointive as opposed to an elected judiciary. She understands how perverse the incentives are in that kind of system. And she has spent a great deal of time trying to preserve appointive systems. Neither she nor anyone else, I think, is naive enough to think that an appointive judiciary makes courts unpolitical. They're always going to have political dimensions. But partisan elections make the situation much, much worse.
Jerry Ann, thanks so much for your call. Mike in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, well, I guess that kind of answers my question, because I was going to ask about term limits. It seems that, to appoint somebody for life to the court, wow, that's a long time.
Jeffrey.
Well, sorry, I lost it there for a second. Life tenure. It's important to remember that the Constitution was passed in the 18th century when people were expected to die in their 50s, to be quite blunt about it. So the idea of 30-year tenures is not something that the framers of the Constitution contemplated. And I don't think it's necessarily a healthy thing that age has become such an important factor. One reason Elena Kagan was appointed to the court instead of Diane Wood is that she was 10 years younger than Diane Wood. I mean, that's something that all presidents are aware of. The problem is it's very difficult to amend the Constitution, and that's what it would take. But it takes a tremendous groundswell of opinion to change the Constitution, and that is not likely to happen. Justice Stephen Breyer has an interesting view about this. He says, I don't have any problem with mandatory retirement or term limits, but what you have to make sure is Supreme Court justice is someone's last job. You should never have a Supreme Court justice angling for something else. And I think that's an interesting observation. But just in point of fact, I don't think you are going to see an amendment to the Constitution to change lifetime tenure, even though a lot of people have real questions about it, including me.
Hmm. We want to find out what Jeffrey thinks about possible retirements, upcoming retirements. And also, we haven't yet talked much about President Obama and how he decided who he would appoint to the Supreme Court and the importance of the Supreme Court in his mind and in Democrats' mind. We talked about the Republicans putting it as on the top of their agenda. What about the president's philosophy when it comes to the court? Jeffrey's latest book is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Jeffrey is a staff writer at The New Yorker, senior legal analyst at CNN, and has written a number of bestsellers, some of which have related to the Supreme Court. Lines are open for you right now. They've been busy, so if you've been trying to get through, try right now, 800 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Kathleen Dunn Show is the Facebook page, and tweet to @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number, and the email is talk@WPR.org. Let's go to an email. Sandra writes, Jeffrey, can you explain what stare decisis, D-E-C-I-S-I-S, is and how Clarence Thomas justifies his stand?
Stare decisis is a Latin term for the rule of precedent, which means that the Supreme Court follows its previous rulings. And if anyone has ever seen any court ruling of any kind, you'll see that there are references to prior decisions, always. Now, the Supreme Court has a complicated relationship with precedent. They always honor it, except when they don't. The Supreme Court has the right to overturn its own precedents. I think all the justices recognize that it's a fairly grave step to overturn a precedent. They don't do it lightly. There is a general belief across party lines that the law requires a certain stability and predictability, so you don't overturn precedents lightly. Justice Thomas has a somewhat different view. He is so strong in his views of the Constitution and his conception of how the Constitution is meant to work that he is much more willing to overturn precedents than his colleagues. Justice Scalia, who is his frequent ally, has even said that Thomas doesn't really believe in stare decisis because he thinks that his view of the original understanding of the framers is so acute and so mandatory that he is much more willing to overturn precedents than his colleagues.
Hmm. Hugh in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. The Friends of the Court filing Friends of the Court notices, I think has become far more important in recent years than, say, a century ago. And this is particularly true in the affirmative action cases in 2003 and again in the cases before the court this month. You have the military-industrial complex, the big corporations and so forth, all in favor of affirmative action, i.e. discrimination against white men. And you have the academia complex, the various academic university crowds also demanding preferences for this group or that and discrimination, again, particularly against white men. It is a pushing the court, showing the power of these military and industrial and academic complexes, but also the political nature of the court and overturning precedent. One of the biggest overturning of precedents was in 1954, when 60 years of segregation as a legal body of declared by the court in the 1890s was overturned in 54. The one thing you didn't mention, or that is rarely mentioned, is the collusion between Justice Frankfurter and those lawyers, not with Marshall. Thurgood Marshall, with the NAACP, was giving arguments that were ineffective on the court.
All right, let's...
Okay, well, he raises a lot of issues there. I mean, just in terms of Friends of the Court brief, I mean, he is right that... many Fortune 500 companies and many retired military officers have weighed in on the question of whether affirmative action should be preserved, and they have said yes. They think diversity is an important goal, and that the court should preserve it. I mean, there is no barrier on anyone submitting a so-called Friends of the Court brief. Many conservative organizations do it as well. There are certainly many briefs before the court suggesting that affirmative action should not be permitted anymore. So it's not like it's all one-sided. But The Friends of the Court brief is a very long-standing institution at the court, and the court is very open in whom it will accept briefs from. I mean, pretty much anyone who wants to can submit a brief. You know, obviously they're going to they don't pay attention to all the Friends of the Court brief. You know, as for improper contacts between Felix Frankfurter and the lawyers, that's a bit before my time. I think a lot of the ethical rules were a lot more flexible in those days. You had Harry Truman playing poker with sitting Supreme Court justices. I think Franklin Roosevelt did it too. That probably would not be seen as appropriate today. So the rules have changed over the years.
Yeah, it's not really the subject of Jeffrey's latest book. Anne in Madison, hi.
Hi, I wondered if Mr. Toobin could talk about the Supreme Court's decisions or non-decisions with regard to Guantanamo Bay and the United States is holding men in confinement without trial for long periods of time, including the majority's opinion of habeas corpus. And as you know, Omar Khadr, the guy who was picked up in either Afghanistan or Pakistan at the age of 15, a Canadian citizen, has spent about a decade at Guantanamo Bay and was released last Friday. He wasn't found guilty of anything. He was a minor. How does the present Supreme Court regard this? I know there have been several decisions or non-decisions, but I haven't kept track of all of them.
Well, the short answer is, you know, during the Bush administration, the court rejected the Bush administration's positions in a series of cases, starting in 2005, the Hamdan case, the Boumediene case at the end of the Bush administration. Since then, the Supreme Court has really just sort of checked out of the issue of Guantanamo. I think I don't know if it's an explicit agreement, but I think they've just had it with the subject. You point out that the issue is not resolved. They are not the legal issues are not settled by any means, but they just are leaving it to the lower courts to deal with, not dealing with it themselves.
Thanks, Ann, for the call. Rich in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi. Considering presidents playing poker with justices of the Supreme Court, the proposal I'm about to have you entertain would mean that the president would lose the poker game. But I'm wondering what you think of the possibility that if President Obama is reelected and if there are some changes in the Congress as well that would enable him to do this, because I watched Bill Clinton at the Democratic convention, and despite his personal life, which one might describe as highly textured at certain points, that's a wonderful mind that operates. He's a true analytic, and I'm wondering what you think. I'm old, even though I don't sound old. I am old, and so I like fireworks. I wonder what you think is the possibility of one of the Clintons possibly being nominated to a seat on the Supreme Court and what consequences of that would be.
It would certainly be good for my business. Talk about an entertaining series of events. I think the answer is it's the possibilities are really zero. First place, they're just too old. I mean, Hillary Clinton is 64. Bill Clinton is, I think, I may be off a little, but they're both in their mid-60s, and no one is going to be appointed to the Supreme Court at that age anymore. Also, you know, they are highly polarizing figures, as you know. I wouldn't necessarily say that that politicians are not out of the question by any means. You have, for someone like, say, Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, or Kamala Harris, the attorney general of California. Those are possibilities. but I don't see the Clintons as a real possibility.
Thank you, Rich, for the call. Can you talk a little bit about expected resignations, how many seats the next president may have to fill? And we have yet to talk about how the president, the current president, has approached the whole business of appointing somebody, what he's looking for, what his judicial philosophy is.
I think this president has had a curious relationship with the courts. He is, after all, a constitutional law professor. He is someone who knows a great deal about the Constitution. But he has been not especially attentive to the issue of the courts. You know, his first Supreme Court appointment was almost easy. I mean, Sonia Sotomayor was sort of genetically designed to be a Democratic appointee to the Supreme Court. She was a Hispanic. She was highly, highly qualified. She'd been a prosecutor. She'd been a defense lawyer. She'd been a it was just all the stars aligned for her in a very obvious way. I mean, the greater paradox for Obama is, what about the lower courts? He has not engaged in filling the seats on the lower court in anywhere near the numbers that the Republican presidents have. He just has not made it a priority, and it's just a tremendous loss for his extended influence. Now, he may get another term, and he may make a greater effort, but so far he hasn't.
Why is that? Is it because he's worried that they'll be rejected, or?
Well, I mean, certainly the Republicans have engaged in a tremendous amount of obstruction of his nominees, but also there is simply he's busy with other things. I mean, you can hardly say that President Obama has had an uneventful 3.5 years as president, but two wars and an economic collapse. But he is definitely has not shown the interest in judicial nominations that Republican presidents have.
Mm-hmm. And possible retirements coming up?
I think certainly the most likely candidate, and it all depends on who wins the election. You know, presidents are very much aware of which president, justices are very aware of which president is in office. Ruth Bader Ginsburg has made it quite clear that she will retire in the next 4 years. But I think if Mitt Romney wins the election, which is looking less likely at the moment, she will probably not retire. But by the same token, she's 79. Antonin Scalia is 76, and Anthony Kennedy is 76. I think they might well retire during a Romney presidency. I don't think there's much chance that they will resign during a Obama presidency.
Mm-hmm. And you end the book with just a little bit on this before we have to say goodbye. When we're looking at judicial philosophy, Obama and his party were the ones who acted like the Constitution remained inert. They hoped the Constitution and the values underlying it would somehow take care of themselves. This has never happened, and it never will. Invariably, inevitably, the Constitution lives.
That's right. I mean, this is the sort of the difference between the conservatives and what I call the conservatives and the change agents, who are the Republicans. The Republicans really want to see the Constitution change, and they have that agenda that I talked about. Whether it's Roe v. Wade or affirmative action or church and state, those are all desires for change. The Obama administration and Democrats generally are interested in sort of the status quo. You know, don't change anything. And that's really what, and that's a real difference between the parties.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeffrey, thank you very much for being with us this hour. Enjoyed the book and the conversation.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Toobin, our guest this hour. His book is The Oath, The Obama White House, and the Supreme Court. Jeffrey is a staff writer at The New Yorker and senior legal analyst at CNN. He's also the author of The Nine, Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, and The Run of His Life. And this book also, we didn't get much of a chance to talk about all the personalities, but fascinating stories about the personalities of all of the members of the Supreme Court, and a lot about Sandra Day O'Connor, too, and what she has done in her retirement, which is fascinating. Well, that's it for today's program. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. Tomorrow, we're going to be looking, the first hour of the program, at media, various forms of media, particularly radio, and we'll, during the 10 o'clock hour, take on one of our favorite subjects, which is books, and get all kinds of book recommendations from Nancy Pearl, one of our favorite book people, and Daniel Golden, another of our favorite book people. So we will be giving you lots of suggestions, and that's tomorrow. Just a reminder, it's a big election time now. All election coverage, go to wisconsinvote.org. Great conversations ahead. Thanks for listening.